morning. My name is Rick Dunning, and the title of this session is A Restless Creation, The Shifting Continents. And this morning I will talk about a scientific theory that helps us to explain many of the geologic features that are present on the Earth's surface. And I will use a number of slides, particularly maps in the form of slides, to illustrate how the processes are working. Now, the purpose of the session, I think, might be best explained as trying to understand creation and trying to understand how creation works. And we'll begin with a slide that was taken just right above the village, from one of the mountain peaks right above the village. And this is looking to the west from what you would see up on the ridgetops here. You see Glacier Peak, which is the closest of the Cascade Volcanoes, and the crest of the Cascade Range. Now, the question I want to start with is, why do we have mountains on the Earth's surface? And secondly, why are those mountains located where they are? If we look at a map of the mountain systems around the world, there are mountains in some fairly specific places. We don't have mountains everywhere. There are no mountains in Minnesota or Wisconsin or in the middle of the continent. The mountains in North America occur primarily along the western edge of the continent. We have the Appalachians in the east, but the highest, most rugged mountains are here in the west. There are mountains in the western part of South America. There are mountains that go all the way around the Pacific Ocean, sometimes referred to as the Circum-Pacific Mountain System. There are also a set of mountains that go all the way across southern Europe and Asia. The Alps and Himalayan system are part of another major mountain system. Those are the mountains that we see on the continents. There are also extensive mountain ranges under the oceans. Those are shown with the blue lines here on the map. A big mountain ridge system down through the Atlantic Ocean, down through the Southern Pacific Ocean, down through the Indian Ocean. So the mountains in the world are in some very specific locations. And if we want to understand the geology and the landscapes that we have on the Earth's surface, we need to understand what processes inside the Earth are responsible for these mountain systems. We need to start by looking inside the Earth itself. Now, if we could cut away at the inside of the Earth, this is the structure we would find on the inside. The very center of the Earth is a solid core. Almost pure iron, very, very heavy, very dense material. Around that inner core, as it's referred to, is an outer core, which is hot, molten rock. And the solid inner core is kind of sloshing around inside that molten outer core. And then the main part of the Earth is the region known as the mantle. And the mantle rock is solid rock, but it's under so much heat and pressure that that rock can move, can deform very slowly, like a plastic can be deformed. So the mantle rock is capable of motion, but very slow, gradual motion. Then around the mantle is a very thin crust, almost like an eggshell. In fact, sometimes I've suggested we could think of the Earth sort of like a soft-boiled egg, with the white being the mantle and the core being the yolk. But that's a little bit simplistic. But what that analogy helps us see is that the crust around the outside of the Earth is very, very thin, just a thin layer of rigid rock around this hot mantle material. Now, on top of this crustal material, the continents sit up as high features above the level of the ocean. The continental crustal material is made of rock that is relatively light and less dense when you compare it with the rest of the Earth's crust. So the continents are little masses of lighter rock material sitting on top of the rest of the crust. Now, the important thing to realize about the crust, about this thin shell around the Earth, is that it's not one solid piece, but it's broken up into sections. And we refer to those pieces of the crust as plates. Now, those crustal plates are shown on this map. We've got 7 or 8 very large plates and a dozen or so small pieces of plate. So North America makes up the North America plate, South America plate, the Pacific plate, the Eurasian plate, the India-Australia plate. The whole crust, this whole rigid outer shell of the crust, is broken up into these plates. The important thing to know about the plates is that they are moving. They are in motion on the Earth's surface. And as these plates move around, they interact with each other along the plate boundaries. And with these plates moving around on the Earth's surface, all the action takes place, if you will, on the plate boundaries, where they collide together or where they spread apart, or where they move past each other. So if we really want to understand how the Earth's surface changes, we need to understand the plate motions and how the plate boundary interactions take place. There are 3 kinds of plate boundaries. One where 2 plates are spreading apart from each other, known simply as a spreading center or a rift zone. The plates spread apart and then hot rock from the mantle rises to the surface and solidifies to make new plate material. The second kind of boundary is where 2 plates are colliding together. And when that happens, one of the plates is forced downward back into the mantle where it will eventually melt and become part of the mantle rock again. The third kind of plate boundary is where 2 plates are spreading past each other, just moving laterally. They're not coming together or spreading apart. Now, here is an example of the original theory was called continental drift. And some of you may have heard of it in that context. According to Alfred Wegener in the early 1900s, all of the continents had been together at one time. And he based this notion on the way the continents fit together, such as the way South America and Africa fit together, and on rock types that matched from one continent to another, and fossils that matched from one continent to another, suggesting that they at one time had been all together and had split apart, and the continents had moved different directions away from each other. Well, when Wegener came up with this notion in the early 1900s, he was essentially laughed out of the place. No one would buy it, in part because Wegener couldn't explain how it happens. He had no way to explain how you get a continent moving from one place to another. Over the years, more and more evidence has been collected on the motion of the continents and the underlying plate materials, and that was the part that Wegener couldn't really understand. He thought just the continents were moving, when in fact it's the crustal plates that are moving, and the continents just kind of ride around on top of the plates as the plates move. Now, this notion of the moving plates is called plate tectonics, and the whole theory of plate tectonics has completely revolutionized our understanding of the Earth and how it functions. Plate tectonics has only been accepted as a valid theory since the late 1960s. So that we're talking about a scientific revolution that has happened only in the last two decades. When I started studying geology back in junior high and high school, nobody talked about plate tectonics. This revolution has all occurred even within my lifetime. Now, let's look at some more careful examples of these plate boundaries. This diagram shows the development of a spreading center, or a rift valley. And it starts with a hot spot in the mantle where the rock starts to rise upward within the mantle. And as that rock rises upward, it forces up the crust above the mantle, and then the plates start to move away from that hot spot. As the plates continue to move away, then you get the development of a rift valley, an actual valley in the landscape. And as the spreading process continues, that rift valley is flooded by the ocean and becomes a long, narrow sea. Eventually, as the plates continue to spread apart, the ocean basin gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and the spreading continues from the mid-ocean ridge area. So where we have those long ridge or long mountain ridges in the oceans, those are the spreading centers where new rock material is rising to the surface and creating new plates, new crustal plates. The most famous example of one of these spreading centers is called the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. This is the Atlantic Ocean. Here's the eastern part of North America, South America. Here's Africa, part of Europe and the British Isles, Greenland up here. Right down the middle of the Atlantic Ocean is the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. This is where plates are spreading apart. New crustal material is being created right in the middle of the ridge, and the Americas plates are moving off to the west away from that Atlantic Ridge, and the European and African plates are moving off to the east. So this is a spreading center, and the Atlantic Ocean is getting gradually bigger and bigger as that spreading process continues. Here's another example of a spreading center in the Indian Ocean. You can see again the ridge system coming down this way and splitting off in two directions. Again, these are points where the plates are spreading apart, where the ocean is getting bigger. Notice the way that this ridge system extends between the Arabian Peninsula and Africa. The Red Sea is gradually opening up into a new ocean basin. You can pretty much tell from the shape of the Arabian Peninsula that it used to be attached to Africa. But now it's begun to split apart and a new ocean is opening up here. There is a rift valley extending all the way down eastern Africa. And all of these lakes that you find down the eastern side of Africa are part of this rift valley that has slowly begun to open up here. Now, yes?
Crossing that rift or all those other lines.
Right.
Are you going to talk about those?
These are simply lateral faults in which parts of the ridge are offset slightly from each other. So all of the ridges are characterized by a number of these fault lines that connect sections of the ridge. Now we also have an example of a collisional boundary where plates are colliding together, and that is where India has collided with the southern part of Asia. India used to be somewhere down in this area, and the subcontinent of India has gradually moved northward and rammed into the southern edge of Asia. And the force of that collision, the force of India and Asia colliding together is what creates the Himalaya mountain system, the youngest, highest, most active mountains on the Earth's surface. They're still raising up today because that collision is still taking place. India is still moving gradually northward. This is great stuff.
Just yeah, you say they're raising today.
Yes.
At what speed or how? They actually have an actual
measure. Yeah, they've actually calculated the rate of uplift, but I'm afraid I don't know what that is. Sorry. The most recent example we have of that activity is the Armenian earthquake, which is a direct result of that continued uplift in that area.
I see.
Yeah. Now, there are several kinds of collisional boundaries. You can have two plates in which you've just got ocean crust colliding together. As I said, when plates collide, one of them is forced downward into the mantle. And in the process, molten rock is created by the friction and the heat of that plate collision. And that molten rock rises as lava to the surface and creates volcanic islands. So that along the collision zone, there's a deep ocean trench right where the plates come together. And then parallel to that trench is a volcanic island arc system. Now, sometimes you have a collisional boundary where ocean crust is colliding with continental crust. When that happens, again, you have one plate diving back into the mantle, and lava generated by the force of that collision. And so along the edge of the continent, then you get volcanoes occurring. And in addition to the volcanoes, the edge of the continent is kind of crumpled up by the force of that collision. So you have mountains created along the western edge of the continent as a result of the force of that collision. And that's the kind of mountains we have here in the Cascades. This is the situation. The Cascades form along the northwestern coast of the United States. They are created in part by the deformation of the crust in this area, and also by volcanoes generated by the plate collision. A third kind of collisional boundary involves two continents crashing together, and we just talked about the example of India crashing into Asia. When that happens, the continental crust, because it is a light material compared to the rest of the crustal plate, tends not to dive back into the mantle, but tends to buoy upward, sort of like a rubber raft on the surface of the water. You can't really force continental crust too deeply.
So that means there aren't volcanoes in the Himalayas?
No, not. There is a little bit of volcanic activity created by this, but volcanoes are not important in the Himalayas.
Unless it goes on your house.
Unless it goes on your house. Now, again, looking at examples of these in the real world, if you will, here we're looking at the western side of the Pacific Ocean. Here are the Japanese islands are one of those island arc systems that occurs along a trench zone. So that as the plate under the Pacific Ocean collides with the Asian plate, then the lava generated by that plate collision creates all of these volcanic island arcs all the way around the Pacific Ocean. The Aleutian Islands of Alaska are part of a volcanic island arc system. So the whole Pacific Ocean is essentially ringed with these kinds of volcanoes created by plate collisions. In the Americas, again, think about where the plates are, where the mountains are in North America. They're on the western edge of the continent primarily. Same is true in South America with the Andes. Remember that North America has been moving westward. And as North America moves westward, this is the leading edge of the continent. This is where all the force of the plate collision is generated. All of the mountains in Western North America have resulted from the collision between the North American plate and the plate that was underneath the Pacific Ocean. The Cascade Mountains today are a continuation of that collision process. Active volcanoes like Mount St. Helens tell us that that plate collision is still taking place today. Now, some people might ask, well, what about the Appalachian Mountains? Those aren't in a collisional position. But the Appalachian Mountains are much older mountains, and they were created by an older plate collision when North America and Europe collided together. So those are remnants of a much older plate collision. The more recent activity has been on the western edge of the continent, where we have our youngest, highest, most rugged mountains.
Great. What explains that basin between the Cascades and the Rocky Mountains?
Okay.
There was first, the Rockies
right.
were formed first, and then the Cascades are the modern.
Let me see if I can address that. There has been, in fairly recent geologic time, the last 5 million years or so, a slight change in the plate boundaries in North America. So that now we have along the southern coast, the southwestern coast of North America, instead of a plate collision taking place, now we have two plates that are sliding past each other. So that now the Pacific plate is moving to the northwest as the Americas plate continues to move westward. So the Pacific plate is sliding past the North America plate. And when the plate motion changed, that's what created this kind of sag. It's almost as if that part of the crust broke and collapsed downward to create this region in Utah and Nevada. It consists of a lot of little fault block mountain ranges and valleys when the crust or the continent essentially shattered in that area. Now, the way that we see that plate boundary today along the southwest coast is the San Andreas Fault. Okay, you can see where the Baja Peninsula has separated away from Mexico. The Gulf of California is starting to open up and spread apart. And the San Andreas Fault runs right up through Southern California, essentially right through that area. The San Andreas Fault is the boundary between the Pacific Plate on the west and the Americas Plate to the east. And the Pacific Plate is just moving sideways past the Americas Plate. So, if you think about what's happening, that means that California is not going to break off and fall into the ocean because the plate motion is sideways, not away from the main continent. If anything, what we'd expect to happen, since Los Angeles is on the west side of the fault, that's on the Pacific plate. And much of San Francisco's on the east side of the fault, on the Americas plate. So gradually, Los Angeles is going to move northward until Los Angeles and San Francisco are side by side. Of course, that disturbs the people in Northern California because they always like to think they're superior to the people in Southern California, right? Of course, they don't have to worry because Los Angeles will just keep right on going and end up underneath the Aleutian Islands someday. Then they won't have to worry about it. Now, here is a map showing those relationships. The San Andreas Fault is that lateral boundary between the Pacific Plate and the North American Plate. Here in the Pacific Northwest, there's a little tiny piece of plate that's still colliding with the edge of the North American continent. This is called the Juan de Fuca Plate, just a little tiny piece that's still being shoved underneath the North American continent. That's why we have volcanoes up in this area, is because we still have that kind of plate collision taking place with the Juan de Fuca plate.
Is there a rift then in the Bay of down by Baja?
Yes, the Gulf of California represents a rift valley, an ocean basin essentially that's opening up.
Okay.
Now, mind-boggling as this may seem, the evidence for plate motion is pretty good. Much of the evidence for plate motion comes from careful measurements of rocks in the ocean basins, measuring the age of rocks in the ocean basins particularly. And if you look on either side of a ridge where plates are spreading apart, the youngest rocks are always close to the ridge, and as you go away from the rocks, or as you go away from the ridge, the rocks get gradually older and older, suggesting that the new plate material is generated at the center of the ridge, and then the plates keep spreading apart. Now, some people have asked how fast these plates move. The best way that I can think of to tell you is that the plates move about as fast as your fingernails grow. That's about the rate at which North America is moving, about as fast as your fingernails grow. So it's moving right along, and when you consider how far it moves in 10,000 or 100,000 or a million years, but it's not the amount of ocean or the amount of motion that we're likely to notice in any one time. The displacement along the San Andreas Fault has been measured fairly well. And in some places, that displacement is as much as 20 or 30 feet within recorded history. So we can measure that plate motion fairly well.
Don't they have some parts where there is a street that someplace it seems I've seen a picture?
Yeah, a street offset from where it originally was, sidewalks. Sometimes fruit orchards in Southern California show that offset a little bit from when the trees were originally planted and where they are now. Again, this is a map of those major plate areas showing the continents in their present position. Here's a map that tries to show you a little bit of the history of the plate motion. About 200 million years ago, all of the continents were together in one giant supercontinent. This is what Wegener referred to as Pangaea, when all the continents fit together. And when Pangaea was created, that's when the Appalachian Mountain System was created by this plate collision that created the supercontinents. Because they had been apart, then they came together to create the supercontinent. And then about 180 million years ago, they started to break apart. The Atlantic Ocean gradually started to open up, and the Mid-Atlantic Ridge System then developed as a spreading center. Here you see India moving its way northward, Australia moving off to the north, Antarctica slipping down a little further over the South Pole. So during the last 100 million years or so, the continents have gradually slipped into their present positions, which we see down at the bottom of that diagram. Now, if we talk a little bit about why these plates move, one of the general theories is that within the mantle, within the hot rock of the mantle, there are convection currents, heat currents. The interior of the Earth is very, very hot, and that heat is gradually escaping out through the mantle. And as the heat from the core of the Earth moves up through the mantle, it sets up motion, very slow flow of the mantle rock. And as the rock within the mantle starts to flow, then the plates kind of ride around on top as if they were rafts on top of the ocean. When we understand plate motion, that helps us to understand a number of very important geologic processes, particularly with respect to human activity. This is a map of where earthquakes are located. And you can see that the earthquake locations pretty much define the plate boundaries. We get most of our earthquakes occurring along active plate boundaries, because as the plates push and pull against each other, then the movement of the crust causes the vibrations that we call earthquakes. If we had a map of volcanoes, that map of volcanoes would be pretty much in the same area. The active volcanoes tend to be along plate boundaries. So a lot of very important geologic processes are related to the motion of plates. And in fact, plate tectonics as a theory finally gives the science of geology a kind of all-encompassing theory to tie together all the different Earth features that have been observed over the centuries. So it has, as I say, within the last couple of decades, become the most important theory in all of the geological sciences. And we end with our sunset over the North America plate. Okay. Can I answer any questions about this? I know it's a little mind-boggling at first. Yeah, go ahead.
I noticed in the North American plate there were a number of dots, say, in the Midwest area. Does that mean there are also faults in there?
In the Midwest, there are some very old faults, deeply buried, that represent very old plate collision boundaries. So, yes, they're
sort of heal, or?
Well, they haven't completely healed, and so they do move occasionally. And in fact, the largest earthquake recorded in North America was in southern Missouri, not in southern California. 1811 or something like that.
Yeah. New Mississippi Madrid. River actually flew back for a while.
Yeah, it shifted the position of the Mississippi.
Yeah. Now, a while back, I think it must have been in the latter 1960s, I read a provocative article on geography that I'd never seen again ever printed, and it was in the Smithsonian Magazine. I took an opposite view of I think it might have taken an opposite view, or be interpreted as taking an opposite view of plate tectonics. And what it did is it somewhat went back to the old Greek dodecahedron theory, and he took the seemingly the preceding map that you had shown there, right, of where the plates are, you know, and he refashioned them and kind of straightened out lines or whatever. Right? I'm not sure what he did, and then he. Actually, the article ended with a globe that you could make out of a sheet of paper. It had the map, it had the plate tectonics in it, and it formed a dodecahedron out of the world. And I think his implication at that time, and this was done by a geographer, not a geologist. And so his implication would be that, and the whole article was under the discussion that many things do shrink and form dodecahedrons, and maybe an implication was that we could explain it, that it was just the natural formation of the Earth.
Gradual shrinkage of the Earth.
Yeah, and that dodecahedron is being the design of the Earth, might sort of speak to geology. Okay, so that's a long discussion on that, but I was just not able to get you familiar with that. Has it ever been, I've never seen any article again post, and
I think, well, one of the alternate explanations for some of these features is the notion that the Earth is kind of gradually shrinking as it cools and shriveling up, and some of the surface features we see are from that process. I think what those kinds of theories have essentially run into problem with is with the modern measurements of plate motion. The fact that we can go out and actually physically see evidence that plates are shifting even within historical time. And
is there anybody of prominence that held this view that which I am stating that you were saying?
I can't think of anyone offhand.
There's no camp or anything?
No. There was, as I say, but even in the mid-60s, there was still a strong camp that was kind of against plate tectonics.
Okay, so this might have been that.
Yeah, it might have been part of that last bastion of resistance to adopting this theory. And plate tectonics doesn't explain everything. There are still some problems and some features on the Earth's surface that haven't been explained. But it goes a long way to bringing together a lot of different geologic features and processes in a coherent kind of theory.
We used to hear a lot of things on ocean mining about 5 or 6 or maybe 8 years ago, where the third world countries were jumping on the bandwagon and trying to force the first world or whatever, to share with them on ocean mining of manganese nodules and everything. and then all of a sudden the whole subject seemed to disappear. Has that all been discontinued as being unprofitable or cost prohibitive, or is anybody still pursuing that at all?
As I understand it, the mining is still going on. There was a major conference to try and sort of work out who owns what's, or who has rights to what sections of the ocean floor, and some of that I think was settled in that conference. The fact that each country has their 10 miles or whatever it is of coastal water plus another 200 miles of fishing rights plus another so many miles of mineral rights on the ocean floor. So a lot of that was ironed out.
I'm sure a lot of that would have been up for grabs, say out in mid-Atlantic or mid-Pacific.
So countries have been extending their boundaries in every way that they can get away with it so far. But a lot of it, as they say, was ironed out in this conference.
And this may not be of general interest to you, to geologists, but you showed maps showing where people, where the continents were believed to have been at various stages in human history, and that the plates in which continents float are still moving. Do people hypothesize where continents will be in the far distant future, and what the Earth is going to be?
Yeah, there's a bit of that with computer modeling. Theoretically, the Atlantic Ocean should keep getting bigger and the Pacific Ocean should keep getting smaller unless some new spreading areas open up to change the plate motion. And that's always possible, that it would move one way for a while and then move a different way. But at the current time, it seems like the Pacific Ocean is getting smaller. There are also some interesting implications when the continents start to get all together on one side of the Earth. What does that do to the orbit? Does it start to wobble and throw off the orbit a little bit? And what implications might that have for climate and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I've been always wondering, at the beginning, the first one, where all the continents were together, mm-hmm. What was counterbalancing that for the isostasy of the Earth?
I don't know. It may be that when they were all together like that, it was throwing off the rotation of the Earth.
Yeah, that's always been a mystery. The other thing is, I always wonder is when I was in San Francisco about a couple of years ago, some lady made the remark of that maybe we'll never have another San Francisco earthquake, of high magnitude. Because of the fact that we are getting earthquakes, very small earthquakes periodically. And they said that, so we don't have to worry about having a big, giant one. It's logically, it sounds like very sound, yeah. But do you think that really would be, and if that was the case, then Seattleites would have to worry about that, because we have the opposite problem, is that we haven't had a nice, juicy earthquake since 1960, I could remember the last one was 65, was it? 64 and 65, and the San Juan, the Fuca plates are ready to go, Okay, so what is your commentary?
Well, the faults are the areas where the crust is moving past each other, the plates are moving past each other, and they do tend to build up stress for a while and then move suddenly and build up more stress and move again.
Right.
And sections of the San Andreas Fault will move independently. It's not all the whole fault moving at once, it's just in short bursts. So there is some basis for that kind of thinking.
Right.
The question is how much of the fault line is being relieved by those little earthquake stresses. And in fact, one sort of theory to try and control earthquakes is to cause them on purpose for that reason, to set off little earthquakes using explosives or injecting water into the fault line to act as a lubricant, something like that, to actually create little earthquakes and relieve the stress. That hasn't been used ever. You can imagine what the liability problems might be if you start going around creating earthquakes, but that is one theory that's been tossed around.
Now, last year we did have a geologist who showed where, because of a large earthquake that occurred in California, they were able to find, discover fault lines they never knew before, and that many developers have built right on the fault line. And,
you know, there are newly discovered deeper faults in the area that
weren't known about. It's interesting that municipalities, especially in California, certain places tend to put their public buildings on fault lines because those seem to be the lowest property values. So,
being a church camp and the church and science, how old do the geologists say the Earth is, and how do they arrive at that?
The current estimates put it at about 4,800,000,000 years old, approximately in that neighborhood. That's based on measurements of the decay of radioactive isotopes, so that radioactive elements that decay very, very slowly through time, you can actually measure how much they have decayed and get an indication of how old the rocks are. Now, the oldest rocks on the Earth's surface are only about 3.8 billion years old. So we don't have any rocks on the surface of the Earth that are as old as the Earth is. So that some of these estimates come from the measuring the age of moon rocks and measuring with the assumption that the Earth and the moon are close to the same age, and the measurement of asteroids, and also the presence of certain elements within the Earth's crust that at least imply that some other rocks had to be there on the Earth's surface a billion years earlier in order for these elements to be present. So there are several lines of evidence that come together on that. But most geologic dating now is based on decay of radioactive isotopes.
How far down have they drilled into the Earth for samples?
As I understand it, on the order of maybe 5 kilometers, they haven't gotten all the way through the crust yet. And the crust is thinnest in the ocean basins, where it's only maybe 5 kilometers thick total, but they haven't gotten all the way through the ocean basins even, and thickest in the continents, where it can be as much as 60 kilometers thick.
In southwestern Minnesota, where we live, about 6 miles away, they found rock, which is supposed to be something almost over 3 billion years
old. Yeah, I've picked up some of that rock in western Minnesota that's over 3 billion years old. I have some at home. Yeah.
Citing what the gentleman was mentioning on being in the church camp, in a probably a portion of thinking, and with the idea of thinking of God creating, could God have created daughter elements along with parent elements, then to give an illusion of age to the earth?
Well, I understand that God has a sense of humor, so I don't want to discount that.
It isn't the sense of humor, because it isn't the humor. The humor is from the interpretation. The humor isn't from the actual fact. In other words, it's the reaction to the fact, not the fact itself. Nothing is intrinsically humorous. Okay.
Well, this is just the scientific interpretation of the world. It's not the only interpretation of it.
I think as our technology progresses, I think it's harder and harder to, when kids ask you these questions, correlating.
Well, in all my research, I still haven't found anything to make me stop believing that God is the creator and responsible.
No, not me either, but the kids, I think.
What caused the ice age?
Well, as North America has been drifting westward, it's also moved northward. And in the movement of the continent to a higher position, and also the movement of Europe and Asia to a high latitude position, is what probably initiated the ice age, because you have land masses now that are at high latitude positions where ice can form on them.
I didn't think these things moved that fast though. It's only 10,000 years ago.
Within the ice age, there are a number of fluctuations, climatic fluctuations, between cold periods when there is a lot of ice and warm periods when there's not very much ice. And we apparently are in one of the warm periods and could expect that another glacier will form and advance again. In other words, the ice age isn't over yet.
How will the greenhouse affect all this?
That's a good question. That's a good question. We may slow down that process a little bit. The fluctuations between glacial periods and interglacial periods seem to be due to variations in the Earth's orbit. In other words, as the Earth goes around the Sun, the shape of its orbit changes and it wobbles a little bit on its axis, so that those minor cyclical changes in the Earth's orbit seem to be responsible for glacial or interglacial climate conditions.
There's another ice age, you just wipe out all of our buildings and everything else.
Buy land in Arizona.
I've heard that some of the explanations for the ice age is that the output of energy from the sun has varied by a couple percent.
Yeah.
And they calculate just a small percentage is enough to upset the apple cart, so to speak, and start this great big engine of our atmosphere to slow down or to speed up. And also that, and it's supposed to be on a set interval of something like 11,000 years, although I think it's varied in intervals more than that. And some people also suspect that as the sun and the rest of the planets travel through the galaxy, they will go through different bands of dust, which inhibits the abilities of the sun to transmit the light and thus energy into the Earth.
Now, and another contributing factor might be volcanic activity, because volcanoes release carbon dioxide, and when you've got a lot of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, that may be a warm period. When the volcanic activity is fairly low, that may be a cold period. Mm-hmm. So the climate system is very, very complex and has even some internal feedback mechanisms that make it more complex, in fact.
How can they measure the rate at which, say, the Himalayas are rising or drifting from side to side, or say if they're going northeast or northwest? Or
anymore, it's based on very careful surveying, actually measuring altitudes and measuring the position of the continents, even from satellite locations where you get off the Earth's surface and have some fixed locations to work with. So they actually can measure the amount of uplift that's taking place.
One time when we were visiting the Living Desert in Arizona, they were predicting earthquakes. A point here and a point way over there in a mountain, as I understand it, and they could measure by
By measuring the tilt or the movement of the crust very slightly, you can tell that the stresses are building up in that part of the crust.
So could you do the same thing?
That's part of how they monitor the San Andreas Fault, is careful measurements of the swelling of the ground or slow movements of the fault itself.
Or animals.
Strange animal behavior, that's been used in China to predict earthquakes.
Gas too.
Yeah, giving off gases from wells, because the stresses in the rocks start to press on the rocks and force out the gases. Yeah. So there are a lot of little precursors to earthquakes that you can kind of monitor and tell when the stresses seem to be building up to a high level. The only successful major earthquake that I know of as being predicted was in China in 1976. And they were able to save a lot of lives from that quake, because an earlier one had killed something like 200,000 people. So that by predicting this 76 quake, they were able to avert a tremendous amount of loss of life there.
Now, this type of current set of things have been moving at a predictable slow rate.
Mm-hmm.
Has there been evidence that it had been moving at a very, very rapid rate? And if so, how fast could the separations be made?
The rate has been variable, apparently. Sometimes it moves a little faster, sometimes a little slower. I don't know that it moves a lot faster ever. And different plates are moving at different speeds. In the Pacific Ocean, the plate is moving 3 or 4 centimeters per year. In the Atlantic Ocean, the plate might be moving 2 to 3 centimeters per year. So the rate varies from one location to another. But I don't think it's ever been a meter a year or 2 meters a year or anything like that, quite that fast. But it has been faster or slower at various times.
Okay, so centimeters.
Yeah.
Will they be able to predict volcanic action accurately?
Volcanoes are a little bit harder. What they can monitor is earthquake activity around the volcano, because as the lava starts to rise up through the crust, that also creates earthquakes. So when you, for instance, with the Mount St. Helens eruption, by monitoring the vibrations around the volcano, they pretty much knew when St. Helens was going to erupt. What they didn't realize was that it would erupt out the side rather than straight out the top. And that's what caused much of the damage, was the kind of eruption, not the timing of it. So they pretty well knew when St. Helens was going to go.
How do volcanoes affect oil reserves in the earth?
That's a tough connection. There are some new theories about the source of oil within the earth, that it may be coming from deep within inside the earth, not from decaying plant material.
Deep inside the earth? Through the molten lava and everything?
From the rocks deep within the crust.
The oil can get through that without blowing up?
Well, as I say, this is a brand new theory that it is not at all accepted yet. But the usual theory to explain oil is that marine organisms get trapped in sediment on the bottom of the ocean, and then the carbon material, the hydrocarbons from the bodies of those marine organisms, under pressure, are gradually turned into oil, which then migrates through the sediments and gets trapped in certain areas within the sediment.
The gas comes from there too, then.
Yeah. So, to the extent that the plate motion creates basins for sediment to accumulate, then yes, oil is related to plate tectonics. But there's nothing about volcanic activity itself that has anything specific to do with it.
Oil continuing to be formed, or is that a fixed?
Theoretically, yes.
It's continuing to be formed.
Yes.
Can we assume in an area like the Cascades here that since there's so much deformation, the mountains are crumpled up like a lot of paper, that there would be fault lines all over this area too, just like, say, an area of shattered glass, or would there be much in the way of faults?
Yeah, we've got some kind of crossing through the Railroad Creek Valley just to the west of us here a little bit. So yeah, there are fault lines through here.
Mm-hmm. Are they active, or are they... Once in a great while, we have a small earthquake, say, in Everett or Marysville.
Yeah. All of them have the potential to move, I think. You can't say that any fault line is ever... Once the crack is there, I don't think you can ever say that it will never move again. Mm-hmm. It just kind of depends on how the stresses of the continuing plate collision work their way through the crust.
How long will it take for water to get into New York City? On that type of thing.
Well, if you believe the greenhouse effect, about 50 years.
50 years.
Because of the melting of the polar ice caps, raising sea level.
Do you believe in that possibility?
Yes, I do believe in that possibility. We have certainly added carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. That can be proven. And carbon dioxide absorbs heat in the atmosphere, so if the atmosphere starts to warm up, then yes, that is a possibility that the ice will melt and the ocean levels will rise.
On those crackers, how do you know they aren't really faulty, they aren't just happening to be certain types of cracks that occur?
because you could, a fault is defined where the crust is actually displaced along the crack. So you have to find evidence of one side of the fault moving.
Yeah. Okay, so they really, you really checked that out.
Yeah, a fault is a crack where movement has taken place. There are lots of cracks that don't move.
Right. Yeah. The other thing is, I want to remark on the idea of the, because it was, I think, Atlantic, wasn't it, Atlantic magazine that had an article on what you were discussing about the oil and the urine. The same way with the idea of methane gas not being something that had really been formed by past plants, but since methane is a very common gas in the universe, that there is methane gas that could be actually be in the United States, entire, in the world. You know, that is not as a result of decayed plants, but actually just methane is a part of our world, our planet.
Just part of the Earth.
Just like any other planet in the universe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Other questions or comments? Well, thank you all for your attention. Enjoy it.
Are you doing another presentation tomorrow?
Tomorrow evening at 6:50 on the Cascade Volcanoes.